Sairam, dear listeners, as we begin the new year with new hope, new energy, new resolutions, maybe even promise to catch up on old resolutions, I welcome each of you to 2018's very first episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and this is a show where I subject myself to your questions. The syllabus is, of course, Swami's crystal clear and profound message. How well I've fared so far, well, I'll leave that to Swami to judge. For our part, let's not stop asking questions. Let our questions come from the deep yearning to know and understand Swami's words better, and more importantly, find practical applications for them in our day-to-day life. Offering our most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet, let us plunge into this week's show. I'm going to deal with an important question today. Much of what I say as part of today's answer, I'm sure I've said as part of many other answers. I still keep getting questions on this particular theme, and that only shows it is an important one. And I've not been able to comprehensively cover it in any one answer that I've given so far. And I don't think I'm going to be able to do that today either. But nevertheless, let's pray Swami helps us understand this a little better at least. But as always, before we get to that, I'm going to read a simple quote for all of you. The quote I'm going to read out today is from an American religious leader and politician, James E. Frost. So the quote is as follows. I quote, "A grateful heart is a beginning of greatness. It is an expression of humility. It is a foundation for the development of such virtues as prayer, faith, courage, contentment, happiness, love, and well-being." End of quote. This is one quality whose importance we can never overstate, isn't it? I think a few weeks ago I did have a question on the value of gratitude where we got to speak extensively about it. But what is this gratitude, and when we feel grateful, what must we do? I think the answer to that depends on whom we are grateful to and what is our own capacity. But what is primarily important is to feel that quality of gratefulness or feel grateful. Swami would always advise us to follow a form of selective amnesia, if we can say that. That is, forget the good that you have done to others, but never ever forget the good that others have done to you. Well, this is quite interesting. Let us say someone helped me when I was struggling in life many years ago. Say they helped me with a sum of about, 100,000 rupees. And I'm grateful to that person. Then a time comes when that person is in need, and say I am now in a position to help him. But this time, say I help him with something like 200,000 rupees. Now, according to that quote of Swami's, of course, I must forget the good I have done to that person, but not what he has done to me. So, though technically I have returned the favor and settled the score more than sufficiently, I will still be grateful to that person because I'm not supposed to remember the good I've done, right? I hope you understand where I'm getting at. Yes, we must feel grateful and express it in some manner. When we serve the society, it is an expression of our gratitude. When we care for our aging parents, it is an expression of gratitude. But there is so much value in that feeling of gratitude itself. That is the reason we must always not forget to be grateful. And that's because, as the quote that I read out today says, many of the qualities that we all wish to and must cultivate springs from this one feeling of gratitude. Swami would often tell our students, be grateful. I am giving you all such good education, be grateful. I am spending so much time with you when so many people are pining for me, be grateful. I am taking care of all your needs, be grateful. But the beauty is, Swami never said, be grateful and come and do this for me. Or be grateful and fund this project of mine, donate to the hospitals I have built. A mother who teaches the child to say thank you does not need that thank you or that gratitude from that child. She teaches the child to say thank you because to be grateful is a virtue that will help the child. Swami reminded us over and over again to be grateful, not because he needed our gratitude or our service in the form of our gratitude. We need that gratitude in us. And when we express it, and as Swami says, don't remember the good that we have done, our gratitude will only grow. And from that feeling of gratitude, all these other noble qualities will spring. So before we head to the question, permit me, dear listeners, to read that quote by James E. Faust one more time. A grateful heart is a beginning of greatness. It is an expression of humility. It is a foundation for the development of such virtues as prayer, faith, courage, contentment, happiness, love, and well-being. Let's head to the question for this week. The person who sends us his question today is a very regular listener. And the good thing is, he has sent his query in his own voice, though he wishes to be anonymous, so we will not name him. I literally prevailed on him to send me the question in his voice, and he was extremely kind enough to relent. So let us listen to the question in the voice of the person who sent us the question, and let's see what we can come up with as an answer to that.
Sairam Prem, wish you and the entire Radio Sai team a very happy and blissful New Year. Thank you again for your tireless dedication and service by hosting this wonderful show. My query originates from a recent discussion you had on Radio Sai Answering Booth regarding the voice of the mind and the voice of the conscience. Ideally, we would all love to be able to hear the voice of the conscience and follow the same, as we would believe this is the voice of God and the correct thought. Also, in daily scenarios, we all usually come across common questions such as, are you a person who follows your heart, or do you try to be practical and follow the mind when it comes to decision making? So, however, there is also a voice of conscience. And now, if I understand correct, if one follows the heart and has a pure intent in the thought or action, which is like a selfless act, that could also be considered to be equivalent to the voice of God. So my question is, how would we differentiate the voice of the heart from the voice of the conscience? Specifically, would we classify a thought or voice as that of the conscience only if it is selfless? Then how about a scenario when somebody wants to pursue a hobby like playing an instrument, which is not really selfless, but they're doing it because they simply love it, which is a voice of the heart? It would be nice if you could bring clarity on this matter, as I believe it would help in better decision making for many individuals in their daily lives. Thank you so much, Sairam.
Thank you, brother, for that question. As I said, you know, it's a question that we've dealt in different forms, and it still begs for a better explanation, because it's a very important topic. Because whenever we talk about practical spirituality, I think this is one thing which comes up. For those of you who are wondering which was the answer that he's referring to, I think it was one of the first answers that I dealt with, and I guess it was recently rebroadcast when this question was sent to me. It was about a youngster who was saying that, you know, his parents want him to take a certain step in his career, and but he has his heart on a particular, I think he wanted to do his research or something like that. And so he asked this question of, you know, this is what my heart is saying, but what should I do? Swami says that we should always follow our heart. So I think in answer to that question, I told him that, you know, what we refer to as following the heart is not what Swami means when he says follow the heart. There's a difference between that. We think that every desire and every passion that we have is a prompting from the heart, and we are pulled towards following that. So I think this question is in the backdrop of that answer that I gave to that youngster. So if I were to break down the question which was given, I think it was articulated quite well. I don't need much of, I don't have to do a surgery on that. But nevertheless, just the 4 or 5 points which stand out, which need to be addressed. One is, what is the difference between the voice of the conscience and the voice of the mind? The second point is following the heart same as following the conscience? As I said, springs from that answer that I gave many months ago. How do you differentiate between the voice of the heart, the voice of the conscience, or the voice of the mind, if they three are distinct and different? And is the voice of the heart or conscience always only the selfless one? I think that's a very important question. Do we always say that the voice of the conscience is always selfless? So if you're having multiple questions in your head, multiple voices in your head, the most selfless one is the voice of the conscience. Is that a thumb rule? Can we go by that? So that's one question. And what about the simple choices that we make in day-to-day life, which cannot be qualified as selfish or selfless? What about those choices, and where does the choice making come from? Does that come from the conscience, or does that come from the heart or the mind? Well, before I go to answering these questions which I just read out, let me answer to the point that the brother had mentioned, that it would be nice that if we all can listen to the inner voice, right? The truth is, we all can, but the real question is, do we all follow it all the time? And the answer to that is yes. Most of us don't follow it all the time. In fact, all of us, because if we are perfectly following whatever our conscience says, then I think we would really be far more ideal and perfect than we are. So it's not that we can't hear the voice of the conscience, because there is that possibility is not there at all. Each one of us can hear the voice of the conscience. Maybe we don't hear it like a voice, right? I think that is the difference. Generally, when we say the inner voice, we think that it is going to be an audible, a baritone voice, which is going to be the voice of God speaking from within. No, it's not that way. The voice of the conscience is available and audible to each one of us. The question is, how often do we follow it, and how do we follow it, and are we turning to that voice every now and then? I think that's the question. See, when we discuss about, when we do a comparative study on religions, when we speak about the various religions, the Abrahamic religions, the religions in the other part of the world, I always see this as one of the standout aspects of Sanatan Dharma. Of course, it is there in many other religions. The more deeper you go into any religion, I think you will come to some of these conclusions. But at least in Sanatan Dharma, it's very obvious. This is one of the rules which is literally given to you when you look at Sanatan Dharma. And that is, God is present in each one in the form of this conscience. Each one has this conscience. And the point of the conscience being present in each one is, I think, universal. Every religion, every belief system talks about it. But this fact that conscience is in fact divine, and that conscience is, it can be directly related to the divine aspect, I think that is a feature which is very, very important when we talk about Sanatan Dharma. And we know that Swami's message comes from there, right? So it is a given that each one of us have the conscience within. That conscience is divine. That conscience is Swami, as we would like to say it, as Swami's devotees. And we all can hear that conscience all the time. Right, so that is a given. But what is the corollary of this when we say that Swami is always inside? It doesn't matter what is upbringing. It doesn't matter whether I was brought up in a particular religion, or I was brought up in a particular belief system, or I was not a Swami's devotee from my childhood, I became a Swami's devotee much later, or I was an atheist, my parents were agnostic, so I was brought up in that. None of these actually matter, because whoever you are, whatever has been your upbringing, the fact that the conscience which is divine is there in you is a given. It cannot be denied. So it doesn't matter whatever upbringing you are, if you have turned to your conscience within, and if you have aligned your life to that voice within, I think you're good to go the distance, right? So I think that is the most positive and the most optimistic aspect about this fact, that the conscience is within each one of us, and that conscience is essentially divine. But the flip side of that coin is, you cannot blame your nurture, or you cannot blame your surroundings, your upbringing, for what you are. Yes, to an extent you can, to an extent. That is why we give so much importance to concepts such as parenting, or the role that education and schools and colleges play in one's life. Yes, the nurturing part is very important, but to only a limited extent we can blame our nurturing for not being good, or not following the righteous path or the dharmic path, because this prompting from within is there for everybody. You cannot deny that. You could have been brought up in the most, brutal of families, which do not believe in any kind of morality. But even then, this voice within is always there. The conscience is always there. The prompting is always there. The more we turn to it, the more we start obeying it, then our life will start changing. So this is something we need to keep in mind. Coming to the questions that were raised. So what is the basic difference between the voice of the mind and the voice of the conscience? Before we bring the complexity of the voice of the mind, how is that different from these two? We'll first handle these two voices, the voice of the mind and the voice of the conscience. As I've said, I've explained this on multiple occasions. There was a child who asked us a question which was very interesting in this regard, and I think I answered that. There was a question on how do you differentiate between good and bad company without being judgmental. I think in that I made references to this. So I'm going to be very brief in this, but this is important to explain so that it flows to the rest of the answer. So I'll just make a brief explanation of what is the difference between the voice of the conscience and the voice of the mind. As we've spoken about how the creation has come to be, we've spoken of how God did not create the world, but a part of God became the world, right? And whenever we speak of it, I mean, there are different schools of thought. There are different schools of thought within Sanatan Dharma itself. But invariably, what most of them agree to is there is divinity, and then there is this second entity which is created, which is called Maya, right? And that is the delusion aspect of divinity, and that is what makes what is one appear as many, right? That's what we often speak of, even when you're talking about Advaita. So these are the two entities which are basic about creation. One is divinity and the other is Maya. And these two, within the human experience, within our perception as we go through this human life, both of these, the divine aspect and the Maya aspect, have representations in the human experience. The divine aspect is represented by this conscience, right, which is also called the Antarvani or the inner voice. Swami says that it is pure divinity itself. The purest form of unmanifest divinity is present as the conscience, and it is called Antarvani. And that's what Krishna also tells Arjuna, that, you know, I am present in all beings, and I'm present in the heart. I forgot the verse where he speaks of this. I am Atma Guda Kesha Sarvabhutasya Stita, something. I'm sorry, I don't recall that exact verse, but this is what he says. I am present in every being as the Atma, and I speak as the voice of the conscience, and that is what is referred to as Antarvani. The Maya aspect is represented in the human experience as the mind, right? And what is the nature of Maya? As we said, that is what makes what is one appear as many. So that is precisely the nature of the mind. This Maya aspect within us creates this idea of multiplicity, right? Or more fundamentally, it creates this idea that I am a separate entity from the rest of creation. This idea of individualistic existence is created by this mind. So that is the basic nature of this mind. And that is the basic nature of what we refer to as the voice of the mind, right? Sorry, I lost myself. Okay, we were talking about, if the Maya aspect is represented in the mind and it is coming from this idea that I am a separate entity, so all of these other qualities of insecurity, of fears, of the feeling that, you know, I need to protect my own interests, all of that comes from the mind. So that is why the basic nature of the mind, and even to a great extent the basic function of the mind, is to protect this idea that this individual, whatever is believed as you, whether you think that I am this body or I am the body-mind complex or I am this personality called so-and-so, the role of the mind, because it is the Maya aspect, is to ensure the progression and the sustenance of this entity, this individual entity which has been created. So that is why this idea that the Maya creates, that I am a separate entity, leads to a form of selfishness, right? So this self-sustenance, which is actually a good thing, without that, I don't think we all would be striving to become better or striving to do something in life, striving to even progress spiritually. So this attitude is good. It's probably the starting point of everything that we do worthwhile. But in the most extreme sense, it becomes very self-serving and selfish. So that is why this conscience is the divine aspect, and that probably is it is the Swami sitting inside, and whatever is coming from the conscience is like the words of Swami. But this mind is having this basic nature of being self-serving and being interested in self-sustenance and self-progression. So that's why the voice of the mind is, loosely put, is invariably selfish, right? But going back to the point that you mentioned, that it would be wonderful if we all can hear the voice of Swami and follow it. As I said, it's not that we can't hear the voice of Swami. We might not hear it as Swami's voice or hear it as God's voice. But the fact is, the promptings are always there. And when we were in Swami's presence, you know, what we learned physically when Swami was in front of us, what we understood, or what the lesson that Swami drove to all of us is, even if Swami is there in front of us, and even if we can clearly hear Swami's instructions, Swami says, do this, this is what I want you to do, the amount we can obey depends on how much we are in control over ourselves. And I always say this, I think I must have mentioned it in the show before, that if Swami comes and tells me, don't sit in this particular place, go and sit in such and such a place, or don't sit, why don't you stand? Or Swami says, no, don't be here, go home and come. All of these things are easy for me to do because these are all physical activities. When Swami says sit, I can sit. When Swami says stand, I can stand. When Swami says run, I can run. But if Swami were to come and tell me that today onwards, you are allowed to think only one thought a day, would that be possible if Swami were to give me an instruction like that? The simple reason is the amount of control I have over my physical frame, over my physical body, I do not have even a fraction of that control over my mind, right? So when we talk about Swami giving instructions and we following, it is not that Swami is not giving instructions, or it is not that we are not following because Swami is not giving instructions. The reason why we are not able to follow is we have very, very limited control over our own selves. So the whole idea of spirituality, and probably towards the end I'm going to speak about that again, which will be the most important part. How do you ensure that you get more control over yourself? That is going to be the most important part, which, because it's important, we leave it to the end. But the whole idea is that how much control we can get over ourselves. We have a fair amount of control over our body. How much more control can we have over our senses, over our mind, over our thoughts? And that will automatically increase our ability to follow Swami. So it is not that Swami within is not giving us instructions. The question is, how much are we able to follow, right? So unless we have this control over our mind, it's going to be impossible to listen to and to follow Swami. Now, coming to the point of when we say I follow my heart and I don't follow my mind, is it equivalent to following the conscience, right? This concept of following the heart, where does that come from? Now, because of this basic definition that I gave, that the mind is driven by fear and it's driven by insecurities, and it is said that the generally one of the things which people say, how do you differentiate between the voice of the heart and the voice of the head or voice of the conscience? They say the voice of the conscience is very firm. It keeps repeating what it has to say and it is very strong, right? That's one thing which generally people say. Now, because we think like this, because we think that the mind is driven by fear and that which comes from the conscience is always firm, I think we tend to think that anything which is persistent within is the voice of the conscience. And any reason that is born out of fear is that of the mind. And I think this is where the misconception comes, that anybody who spontaneously does whatever they feel like doing, or, oh, today I just wanted to do this and I do it, so I'm a person who follows the heart. Or, you know, I want to do this, but I'm deliberating, should I do this or not? So you're a person who follows the head. I think this definition comes from this loose understanding that just spontaneously doing whatever you want to do or whatever you feel like doing is following the heart. I think it's not true at all. Because the idea that whatever is consistent or whatever is persistent is conscience has an inherent flaw in it, right? And similarly, the idea that any kind of reasoning or any kind of debate which happens in the mind is not always born out of fear or not always coming out of the idea of the mind. There are some things that basically, this is a fundamental idea that we can have, but it gets distorted under certain circumstances. I think that is what we need to remember. And when we go into that, we'll realize why following the heart is not the way we think following the heart is. So what are the things which actually distort this? What are the things which distort the idea that everything that is persistent is not the voice of the conscience? One of the things, or one of the most important things, is any kind of strong desire, or what we sometimes refer to as our passions, right? That invariably distorts this idea, because a strong desire will keep reappearing and it'll keep persisting and will keep trying to push you to do what it made the impulse of that desire, right? So it will be very strong, it will be very persistent, and because it's persistent, if we think that everything that is persistent is the voice of the conscience or the voice of the heart, we think that, okay, you know, I want to be a musician. That's not what my parents want. That's not what is the most logical thing to do. But, you know, this prompting is so strong that I'm going to follow my heart, right? This is something which we say. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm not saying that you should not do that. I think we all should do what makes us happy. And if there's an opportunity for us to do that, and why not? I think we should do that. Whatever profession and whatever career gives us happiness, as long as it doesn't mean that it is something wrong, I think we should pursue it. There's nothing wrong in that. But considering that as the voice of the conscience might not be the right thing, right? So a strong desire, and especially in the youngsters, when there's a strong desire, especially in reference to a career option or in reference to liking a person, we generally think that, you know, oh, this is what I want to do. This is what my heart is prompting. So a strong desire will tend to distort this idea of what is the voice of the conscience and what is the voice of the mind, actually, right? And what are the other things which can cause this distortion, right? This is again very important. Any of these other strong emotions that we feel, a strong sense of anger, lust, or greed, hatred, jealousy, and more importantly, something like a quality like vengeance, right? All of these are so persistent. Unless we labor to remove these qualities from us, if we are angry about something, or if we've become jealous of some person, these again become very, very persistent ideas in our head. So they are, again, you cannot tell that because they are persistent and because they keep coming again and again, they are the voice of the heart or the voice of the conscience. And probably that's why when Swami says follow the heart, Swami is definitely referring to the idea of following the conscience. Because Swami would make this very clear. When Swami is saying heart, Swami is referring to Hridaya, right? And that Hridaya is the seat of the Atma, seat of this feeling of the divinity, the most pure form of divinity which is there. It is said to be in the deepest cave of your heart. So when Swami says follow your heart, Swami is certainly referring to the idea of following the conscience. But many of these ideas of passion, strong desire, strong ambition, or strong vengeance and strong greed and strong anger, they actually come from the mind. They do not come from the conscience at all. They come from the mind and they are emotional, they are feelings. So when we say following the heart, it does not mean following your emotions. It does not mean just going by your feelings, right? For some people it might work and they might feel comfortable doing that. But it is, if it's something that works for you, if you're a person who tries to feel and go by the emotions, I think you're absolutely welcome to do that. It's not wrong, but you cannot guarantee that that is always following the conscience, right? Now, just as we think that every gut feeling that is coming within us is the voice of the heart, as I said, we confuse anything that is firm to be the voice of the conscience. Similarly, we confuse that every logical argument which comes is actually a voice of the mind, which is born out of fear, and that is why reason and logic come. Again, this is a misconception I think we have to overcome, because this kind of reasoning which happens in our mind sometimes is very, very important, right? Many times the head will throw up this particular question. Like when you want to do something, when you want to achieve something, or you want to take up a particular task to do, the mind might throw up this question, you know, what is it that I'm going to get out of it? Is it worth doing it? And, you know, is it going to benefit me in any form? I think these arguments are probably from the mind, because as I said, the mind is based in this idea of self-sustenance, which gets distorted and which gets in its extreme form becomes selfishness. So these kind of ideas, what is it there? What is there in it for me? what will I benefit if I do this? These arguments are certainly from the mind, but not all arguments are necessarily from the mind, and we'll come to why that is so. But for that, I think we'll have to go back to the fundamental description of the mind, revisit that concept of the mind we've spoken of so many times on this show, on the other shows that we've done, be it Shravanam, Mananam, Nididhyasanam, all the afternoon satsang. We go back to this, the description of the mind, of mind having four attributes or four parts to it. It's not necessarily four parts, but four attributes or four qualities, and we refer to them as Manas, Buddhi, Chitta, and Ahankara, right? And among these, Swami says that which is closest to the Atma or the divinity within is actually the Buddhi. But before that, probably I'll just quickly tell you what are these various things. Manas is the working mind. You know, it is the mind which just gets the work done. Like suppose, I want to write something, or let's say I want to cook something. That which helps me do the basic reasoning and the basic thing of what am I supposed to put in that, and what am I supposed to light first, or what am I, write down my thoughts. That basic working aspect of that is taken care of this manas, right? Then when we come to buddhi, the buddhi is supposed to be the discriminating mind. We'll come to that a little more deeply. The mind which actually says what is right and what is wrong, what can be done, what should not be done. The ahankara is, of course, the ego. And that again plays a very, very important role. And I'm going to leave the ahankara's influence on this particular theme right to the end, because it's a very important one. I will not dwell much into it, but I'll make a mention of why this ahankara needs to be addressed. And the other thing which needs to be spoken of is this entity called chitta. The chitta is supposed to be this conglomeration of all our memories, all our tendencies and vasanas and all that put together. It's often described as the hard disk, which kind of is what makes you what you are, right? If I'm passionate about something, if I'm passionate about music, or if I like a certain kind of lifestyle, or if I am scared of a certain kind of things, all of this programming comes from this chitta aspect of the mind. And Vedanta says that this chitta is something which is populated over many, many lifetimes. That's why we have unknown fears. We like something which we have never done in our life. Many things like this. We like certain kind of people. We don't like certain kind of people. All of this programming comes from the chitta aspect. Now, going back to this concept of the buddhi, there's a very beautiful description which is often given. The buddhi is supposed to be, as I said, the closest to the Atma of all these other aspects which we spoke about. The buddhi is supposed to be the closest to the Atma, and it is like something like a mirror which reflects the light which comes from this Atma, which is divine. And when we speak of Atma, when we speak of decisions, this Atma is actually not any different from the conscience, which is not any different from the voice within. So think of the Atma as a luminescent light within. And this buddhi is said to be the closest to this Atma. And the light which shines from the Atma falls on this buddhi. And Swami says, from the buddhi, it goes on to the manas, which is the working mind. And through the mind, it goes into the senses. And that's how we do whatever we do, whether it is the way we perceive the world or the way we react to the world. The jnanendriyas and the karmendriyas, they are activated in this process. The light of the Atma shines on the buddhi. From there, it is shined on the manas, or the working mind. And through the mind, the manas, it is reached out to the karmendriyas and jnanendriyas. And that's how we interact with the world. That's how we respond to desires. That's how we respond to stimuli from outside. And this is the whole process. But the thing is, if the buddhi is a mirror which is going to receive light only from this voice of the conscience, I think we will not have any problem. If we have to make a decision, it's so very easy to make a decision, right? We know that what is the right thing to do. But the thing is, there is another reflection which falls. I'm just saying this for the sake of understanding, if you can imagine what I'm saying. There's another reflection which falls on this mirror of the buddhi, and that is what we refer to as the chitta, all the tendencies and the vasanas and the fears and the desires and the likes and dislikes, all of that. Even that falls on this buddhi. So whenever there is a situation where we need to take a decision, we need to choose between one and the other, this buddhi, as Swami says, is what is referred to as the nischatmika buddhi, or the buddhi which discriminates or chooses one over the other, right? This is what the buddhi is supposed to do, and it is also called viveka, right? Buddhi is also referred to as viveka or spiritual discrimination. The word viveka itself means to separate one from the other. So that's the role of the buddhi. And how does this buddhi do? From one hand, it's getting this strong reflection of the conscience. And from the other hand, it is getting this reflection of the chitta, or all these desires and fears and vasanas and tendencies. So in any situation when the buddhi has to make a decision, it actually starts debating based on these two reflections which fall on it, right? So when the passions drive you towards a particular choice, if the vasanas drive you towards a certain thing, you know, let's say a quality or an act like an act of vengeance, your vasanas is such that you're an aggressive person by nature. So this aggressive nature of yours is pushing you towards taking vengeance towards another person. But at the same time, the voice of the conscience may be coming in and saying, no, this is not the right thing to do. You should be a little more calm. Don't do this. This is not the right thing to do. So when this kind of a situation happens, what does the buddhi do? There is this drag to do what the vasanas or the tendencies are prompting you to do. But then the conscience is actually becoming a little, is giving this caution that you should not be doing this. Don't do this. So what happens is, in our head there is a debate. In our head there is a reasoning which goes on. Should I do it? Should I not do it? Right? And this is a very, very important essential reasoning that needs to go on. So if we say that every debate which happens in the head and every reasoning which happens in the head means that I'm following the mind and I should not follow the mind, I think it's very, very wrong. In fact, we should be doing this as much as we can. Whenever there is a decision, we need to weigh the possibilities, and it is not about where I will get more benefit or where I will earn more or where I'll make, I will be the winner or where I'll be the loser. That is not the question which needs to be debated in the mind. But is this the right thing to do? That debate, I think it's very, very important that we all do. So in the name of anything that is a reasoning is from the mind, and I'm not a person who takes decision from the mind, I think that's something which we need to avoid. Yes, any decision we make, we need to pause and ask this question: is it right to do this? Am I right in making this choice? Am I right in continuing to do this? I think that is very, very important, right? So that is why I said everything that is firm, as I was talking, everything that is firm and it is which is persistent in its instruction is not necessarily the conscience. And everything that is creating this confusion in the mind is not necessarily the mind, right? Sometimes it could be the caution which is coming from the conscience. So we need to understand this and not follow everything that is persistent inside, and not necessarily follow, avoid every debate which happens in the mind, right? So this is one point I think we all should keep in mind. Now coming to the point of, probably I'll just summarize whatever I've said so far and then go ahead. So in all this, what I wanted to say is, everything that is persistent is not the voice of the heart. And we mistake promptings of strong emotions like desire, anger, passions, revenge to be the voice of the heart. And every reasoning that happens in the head is not necessarily bad. In fact, most often it is the right thing to do. If you take a decision after such deliberation, that does not mean that you're acting from the head. And it does not mean that you're acting from the head against acting from the heart. In fact, you might be acting from the head when you're following something passionately which comes from you, or something which says that, oh, I have to have this thing. There's a strong desire and you follow it. I think in that case, you're actually following your mind. And when you deliberate and you say, no, this is not the right thing for me to do, and you debate it in your head and you say, no, I'm not going to do this, I think that time you're actually following the conscience or following the heart, right? So this is something which we need to remember. So now we come to the most important point. So how do we differentiate? How do we know that which is the voice of the conscience and which is the voice of the mind? The point that you made, brother, in your question is very, very important and very right. The most basic definition can be said that the voice of the conscience is always selfless. That is something which we always say, and we say the voice of the mind is invariably selfish. As a basic definition, yes, we can go by that. For most part, we can use this thumb rule and say that that which is selfless is the inner voice, that which is selfish is the mind's voice. And this is more because, as I said, the mind's nature is that of Maya. The Maya leads it to think that it's a separate entity, and because it thinks it's a separate entity, it comes, fear and insecurity comes. Because of that nature, I think invariably the mind is selfish in its promptings, invariably. And in the backdrop of that selfishness, it's very easy to discern the selfless voice as the voice of the conscience. But I would refrain, or I would suggest, that let's not take it so simplistically. It is not necessarily that every time what appears like a selfless voice is the voice of the conscience. In fact, it's much, much more subtle than that. And I think it's very important that we don't generalize this as everything selfless which comes from within is the voice of the conscience. I'll come to that. I'll explain that a bit. The reason why I'm saying this is, that is what makes this dialogue, which we often refer to, and I think in all my programs I invariably end up making a reference to it, the dialogue between Lord Krishna and Arjuna, what we refer to as the Bhagavad Gita. Because what Arjuna was saying when he dropped his bow and he said, I'm not going to fight, appeared like a very, very selfless thought. He said, I'm not going to fight because I don't want to kill these people. I don't want to rule a kingdom over the dead body of people who are dear to me, who have helped me. We started off the program with a quote on gratitude, right? So why would anybody want to be ungrateful to somebody like Bhishma or his own guru, who is Drona? So it appeared like a very, very selfless thought that Arjuna was saying that I don't want, in fact, I'm ready to renounce everything. I'll go and sit in the forest. I'll become a sannyasi. I don't need anything. That seemed like the most selfless thing to say. That here is Arjuna, undoubtedly one of the greatest warriors, and you can be sure that he's going to go into the battle and win it. There's no way Arjuna is going to lose, and with Krishna by his side, there's absolutely no possibility that he'll lose. And he's choosing renunciation over victory. Can that be more selfless than that? Right? But the whole Bhagavad Gita is about how Krishna tells Arjuna why he is wrong. And what does he say when he says that why he's wrong? He's saying that you think that this is a selfless act, but this is actually not a selfless act. So that is why I'm saying that we should not come to this idea come to this very, very generalized conclusion that everything that is selfless within is actually a voice of the conscience. The reason is, if we go back to the other question that you mentioned, what about the choices that we make which are very, very mundane, right? Which need not be qualified as selfish or selfless. I go into a shop, I'm supposed to buy a shirt, and I'm choosing between a red color and a blue color. I choose one color which appears to me as nice and interesting. So am I listening to the voice of the conscience then? Or, let's say I'm choosing a hobby. I have free time, I want to do something. So I probably choose a hobby of stamp collecting or gardening or something like that. So where is the question of anything being selfish or selfless, right? So I'm just choosing something which is of interest to me and I'm doing it. The reason this question is important is the nature of decision making the conscience is involved in is very, very important to see. And that is what will give us the answer to, is the voice of the conscience always selfless? The reason I'm saying this is, many of these choices that we make in life are actually not very important at all. We give a lot of importance to them. And some of the choices seem like very, very important, like for that matter, even choosing a life partner, choosing a career, choosing a house which we want to buy. We think that these are all very, very important decisions that we make, and we give a lot of importance to them. In fact, they are not as important as we think they are. In fact, this morning's Science Pius quote, I think it was a very, very beautiful quote, and it really needs us to go back to that in the context of what I'm saying. In fact, I just have it here. Probably I'll read out those first few lines of that quote. Swami says, life is a newspaper. Read it casually, a few columns and headlines that catch your fancy and throw it aside. Do not consider it any more important than that. Remember, today's newspaper is tomorrow's waste paper. So too, life is worth only a casual perusal. We give a lot of importance to some of the decisions we make. Of course, the idea of going to a shop and buying a cloth is, buying a shirt is something which is very, very mundane. But even the choices which we think are very, very important are going to define our life are not as important as we think they are. So that is why this idea of, oh, I want to become a doctor and that's a more selfless thing to do. And no, I'm going to become a banker and that's a more selfish thing to do. So I'm going to choose between this. I think that confusion comes from this idea that the conscience is involved, or the inner voice is involved in all these kind of petty decision making. In fact, I'd like to narrate one incident which happened to one of my friends. You all must be aware that many of the students happen to wait for a period of time after they finish their graduation. Those students who wish to stay and serve Swami in the organization or in the ashram, they would wait for Swami to give them instructions. And invariably, there would be this desire that Swami should choose for me what I'm supposed to do, whether I should go into research, or I should become a teacher, or I should join Radio Sai, or I should join the Central Trust. So this desire that this career choice that I'm making is so very important to me, and Swami has to make this choice for me. And one of these students who was waiting and whom I know well, he was saying this. He waited for many, many years, and then 2011 came and the whole situation changed. Swami decided to withdraw his physical frame. And he was saying that he was so lost, because for so many years he was waiting for this career option or this career choice to be made by Swami. And all of a sudden this opportunity was taken away from him. And he was saying that, what am I going to choose? Because this was such an important choice that I had to make, and I'm waiting here for so many years for Swami to make this choice for me. And Swami is left without making this choice. And interestingly, he says that when he was thinking of all these for a few days after Swami had withdrawn his form, Swami comes in a dream. And he was very happy to see Swami in the dream, because he was thinking that probably in the dream Swami is going to guide him as to what career he needs to choose. But what Swami said in the dream was very beautiful. Swami said, see, had I given you a job somewhere, I would have given you a job maybe in the book trust or in the central trust or something in the ashram. And after a few years, depending on the need and the necessities in the ashram, they might have shifted you to another place, right? And when that happens, you have to accept it, right? Or Swami might come and tell you that in fact, many of the boys who work in Radio Sai, for instance, Bishu started his career in the hospital, and from the hospital he went to the IT center, and from the IT center he came to Radio Sai. And of course, most of it were decisions approved by Swami. But this is something which happens all the time. So Swami was telling this boy that, I could have made that decision for you. I could have told you that you can go and work here. But the fact is, it's going to keep changing. Your life is going to keep moving on, and this decision is going to become one of the many decisions. Swami said, it is not as important as you think it is. What is important is, whatever work you're going to take up now, do it for Swami, do it sincerely, and do it as an offering to Swami. That is what is important. So many times we think that the career choices we make are so important, the life partner we choose is so important, the house that we are going to buy, or the city I'm going to settle in, I'm going to go abroad, should I go, should I stay? We give a lot of importance to these choices. Many times the decision making happens only in the mind. We just sit down, we weigh our options, be absolutely logical, be considerate about the people around you. And yes, whenever that situation comes, when our decision is going to affect the other person, either positively or adversely, I think that is when the conscience steps in for the decision making. Because going back to, what is the choice the conscience makes? The only choice the conscience makes is this the right thing to do? Am I taking the right decision? Am I doing my duty or not? I think the conscience invariably answers only to that question. And that is the question we need to ask, not whether, is this the selfless thing, or is this the right thing? Is this going to benefit me? Is this not going to benefit me? Then we think that, okay, this is not going to benefit me, so this is the voice of the conscience. Let's do this. That's not how we we interact with this voice of the conscience, the question that we need to ask is, I am in this situation, these are the choices before me, what is the right thing for me to do? In the situation I have been placed in, what is the right thing that I am supposed to do? Which is the right direction I am supposed to take? And I think it is for that question the voice of the conscience gives a very clear answer. And again, whether we follow it or not is a different topic altogether, it's a different theme altogether, but the conscience does answer to this. Apart from that, all the other various decisions that we make, simple decisions, even what we think are very, very great decisions, they all happen from the mind, and most often they all happen from the tendencies we have collected over many, many lifetimes. Somebody, you know, very naturally gravitates towards a job which is something like a profession, a medical profession. Somebody very naturally gravitates towards the show business. These are all tendencies that we have gathered over many, many lifetimes. And it is these promptings, these are not necessarily the voice of the heart. These are voices of our vasanas and our tendencies. It's not wrong. The voice of the conscience will not step in and say that this is wrong unless we are choosing a profession or choosing a path which is going to harm the others. That's why when the others come into the picture, this idea of the conscience resisting it or saying that this is wrong or think about it comes into picture. So is the voice of the conscience always selfless? Going back to that example of Arjuna and Krishna and what Krishna explained to Arjuna, what Arjuna was saying appeared selfless, but that selfless act also was being prompted by the goodness which had been conditioned into him, right? That is the important point that we need to remember. He was conditioned to be good. It was easier for him to give up than to fight. It was easier for him to be magnanimous, right? So that time, when the voice of the conscience says, no, this is the right thing to do, what you are actually giving up is your own conception of what is right and wrong. You're giving up what is your belief system of what is right and wrong. So it is a form of selflessness, but it is a very subtle form of selflessness. You are ready to give up even what you think is a selfless thought, right? So that is why I always hesitate to say that the voice of the conscience is always selfless. The voice of the conscience is always right. It tells you what is the right thing to do, and most often it has overtones of selflessness, if I could put it that way. So that is one of the ways we can identify it, but invariably it's much, much more subtle than just saying that it's a selfless thought. So the question that we need to ask if we really want to find out an answer from the inner voice is, what is the right thing for me to do? And when the voice prompts us to do something, following that might lead us to have reverses and losses in the immediate future. It might hurt us. We might lose our job. We might lose a promotion which we might get otherwise. Or we might get into wrong books with the people around us. We might be in the losing side in the immediate future. But when we still say that, no, I'm going to follow it, I think that is the form of selflessness which Swami expects when we follow the heart or follow the conscience. So all of this is fine, but what do we do? How do we differentiate? As I said, it's not about we not being able to hear the conscience or we not being able to decipher which is the conscience and which is the mind. In fact, most often we can. The problem with all of us is, it's like, let's say I'm going on a boating expedition and I don't know swimming. There is this boatman sitting next to me and something happens and there's a storm and the boat starts rocking. When I'm about to lose my balance and I'm about to fall into the water, I can't turn to the boatman and tell him that, can you teach me swimming now because I'm going to fall into the water. If you want to learn swimming, you have to learn it when the conditions are far less hostile than it is then, right? The problem with most of us is when we are pushed to the corner, when we are in a crisis situation, that's when we start asking, which is the voice of the mind, which is the voice of the conscience, I'm not able to make out. Yes, you and I cannot make out at that time, because that is not the time to learn swimming, right? When you're losing your balance and falling into the water. So this process of learning to listen to the conscience is a lifelong process. It involves a lot of things, and more importantly, as I started off by saying in the beginning, it involves mind management or mind control. And probably before I end, I'll quickly tell the three techniques which Swami says. These are three techniques that I'm sure each one of you must be doing, especially or Swami's devotees or people who are following Swami for many years. These are all things which you'll be doing. In fact, anybody who is in a spiritual path or who follows a particular religion diligently and sincerely will be doing most of these things. The first thing is, you need firmness of mind. You don't want your mind to be wandering all the time. You don't, and that is when you are not able to follow what Swami wants you to follow. As I said, if Swami comes and tells me, I don't want you to have bad thoughts, the reason why I'm not able to do that is the mind is not in my control. It's all over the place. It's here one day and it's there the next moment, right? So that is why the firmness of the mind is very important. I should be able to do what I want with the mind. So that comes, Swami says, all that what we do in the name of japa, dhyana and the prayers and all of these things, meditation, all of that helps us stabilize the mind. When we sit and do bhajans, when we go and do seva, all of these sadhanas which we do stabilizes the mind. The next aspect is the dirt in the mind. As I said, you know, the buddhi is a mirror. It reflects the voice of the conscience as well as it reflects the chitta or the tendencies that we have carried with us over many, many births. So one of the ways by which we can listen to this conscience more is when we are able to align our mind as much as possible to the voice of the conscience. And that is nothing but the process of purification, right? What Swami would refer to as chitta shuddhi. And for that, again, whatever we mentioned about japa, dhyana and prayers and seva and all of that, even that contributes to chitta shuddhi, right? That's one of the processes by which it happens. But the other thing which Swami would very often refer to is when you avoid accumulating more filth in the mind, right? You do things and you keep company of good people, you keep company of good things. The way you consume media, the way you consume literature, all of that matters. So that is what conditions this mind. So Swami says, the food that we eat, the reason why Swami says don't indulge in intake of intoxicants, don't eat non-vegetarian food, don't eat food which has been earned by unrighteous means, all of this affects the mind. So Swami says that one of the ways by which you can clean the mind so that it distorts less the voice of the conscience which is falling on the buddhi is through all of these processes. You know, when we were all children, when we were probably 1 year old or 2 year old, we are given a certain kind of food. We are either given mother's milk or we are given, some of these foods which are very, very easy to digest. Why are we given that kind of food? It's because our internal organs are not strong enough to do what they are meant to do. The kidney is supposed to separate, what is good from what is bad. The intestine is supposed to do a little bit of that. I'm sorry, more than the kidney, the intestine is supposed to do that. It is supposed to see which is that which can be, you know, let out of the body, which is that which can be absorbed. The liver plays a very, very important role. So in the baby, when these organs are not completely evolved, we decide, okay, this is the kind of food the baby can have. But when we grow up, when we become complete adults and when we have a good digestive system, then the amount we can consume, actually the variety increases, because this discrimination happens within, right? So this is what Swami says, when we are new to the spiritual path, the discrimination of what goes inside, that should happen outside of us. We should see what are the kind of things that we read, what are the kind of people we keep company with, what are the kind of food that we eat. But the moment we start becoming stronger and stronger, and as we progress in the spiritual path, Swami says that, you know, this discrimination happens within us. The mind says that, no, I'm not going to hold on to this, I'll discard it. So till that happens, this external choice between what is good, what is right, and what can be accepted, that is very important. So that is the part where the mind gets purified, the chitta shuddhi happens. Now finally, the role of the ego. I think that's the most important thing. I said I'm going to come to it right in the end, right? What does this ego do in this whole scenario that I said? There is this conscience which is reflecting on the buddhi. This ego, Swami says, is the most subtle in all of these things. Because this ego is the one which creates the idea in the buddhi that I am this body, I am this personality, I am so and so. You know, I have an honor like this, I have respect like this, and you know, I am a VIP in the world, whatever it is. All of this association comes from the ego. The ego is the one which makes the association. Swami would often say, the Atma is aham, right? It keeps saying, I am, I am. It's the ahankara which makes this I am attached to the body or the personality or the mind or the achievements of the person, right? And when this ahankara comes and makes these associations, that's when the mind starts getting active. Because now the mind starts trying to protect whatever this ahankara is associating with this personality. So if you think that you're a rich man, the mind starts thinking that I have to protect this wealth because this is part of me. If the ahankara says that, oh, these are all your family members, then the mind starts thinking that I need to protect these family members at the cost of everybody else. I don't care. This is my family. I need to protect them. So Swami says that this is the ahankara which really comes in and very, very subtly distorts this. So all the spiritual practices that we do is at one end to sublimate the ahankara, but Swami says that there is another way by which you can use this nature of the ahankara too. And how is that? Swami says, when you use the ahankara to make a different kind of association. So Swami says, tell yourself, I am not an animal, right? And that's the first thing which Swami says. And he says, I am not this body, I am not this mind. So you are dissociating the ahankara from getting itself attached to any of this. And for us Swami's devotees, Swami says, remind yourself, I am a Swami's devotee, I am a Swami's student, I am a Swami's child. And when you make this new association, the mind is something which just works on whatever association is given to it. So now the mind says, okay, this is a new quality that you're given. You're a Swami student. So the mind starts thinking, I need to come up with those choices which will protect this identity that you have created for yourself, that I am a Swami student. Right? So Swami says you can use this quality of the ahankara in this manner. When we do this over a long period of time, especially when we start young, when we start in a young age, we will start making these choices very, very often. And the last point I'm going to conclude with that is, Swami says, the more you listen to the conscience, the more clearly you'll be able to listen to it. The more every day we practice this idea of making choices based on what the conscience is saying, right and wrong, you will find that in more complex situations, you'll be able to discern the voice of the conscience from the voice of the mind. If you are able to learn swimming in a swimming pool in the comfort of your home or in the comfort of an academy, you will be able to swim even if you're thrown into a stormy ocean, right? So this idea of how do you discern between this and that, I think we cannot start doing that when we are in crisis. We need to start doing that when everything is calm and pleasant. As I said, I'm not sure I've completed everything that can be said on this topic. I hope I've added more clarity than confusion. So thank you, brother, for asking that question. I hope it has helped you in some manner. If you have anything more to ask, if there's any more clarification you wanted to be done on the show or otherwise, you're free to write to me. So with that, dear listeners, I'm already running into the next show's time. I'm going to conclude. If you have a question like the one I handled today, feel free to record it in your voice and send it to me. My mail ID is prem@radiosai.org. That's prem@radiosai.org. I'll be happy to answer your question. If you wish to be anonymous, do let me know. I'm not going to mention your name. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. Thank you all for joining me on this first show of 2018. I'm going to leave you with a song, only so that I can give time for Bishu and his guests to come and take their place. I'll meet you again next week at the same time for the next episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth.
Is bechain duniya ko dekh na raha mere gham ka thikana ki in logo ne ab tak ये न जाना साई नाम है अनमोल खजाना अन्न अनंत समय पछताए क्यों जब प्राण तन से जाएंगे छूट। ओ मेरे साईं बाबा तेरा हम नाम लेंगे, तुझे है कसम हमारी तेरे लिए जान देंगे, कि साई नाम सारा जग देखो गुनगुनाएगा। मेरे साई बाबा तेरा हम नाम लेंगे, तेरे लिए जान लेंगे, तेरा हम नाम मेरे साईं बाबा ये वादा हमारा
वादा है हमारा, तेरा हम नाम लेंगे, ये वादा है हमारा तेरा हम नाम लेंगे,
तेरे ही संग रहकर तुम्हीं को प्राण देंगे,
तेरे ही संग रहकर तुम्हीं को प्राण देंगे, तेरे ही संग रहकर तुम्हीं को प्राण देंगे,
कि साईं नाम सारा जग देखो बाबा तेरा हम नाम लेंगे, तेरे लिए जान देंगे मेरे साईं बाबा।
रौनक आई
तेरी एक नजर से साई दिलों में खुशी समाई,
दिलों में खुशी समाई, दिलों में खुशी समाई,
तेरे इस रूप को देख कर वो बाबा मेरे हर एक इंसान तुझ पर आज कुर्बान होगा।